Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." The man with the 2 talents also came. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. "Master," he said, "I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you." His master replied, "You wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown, and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him, and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth."
I don't know whether you've waited for things in your life. I'm sure we all have. When I was a teenager, I used to go to school in a town 3.5 miles from where I lived, so we used to catch the bus every day. And the school was not actually in the town, so sometimes we'd catch another bus up to the school if we couldn't be bothered to walk up the hill, because I was a teenager and, you know, sometimes you can't be bothered. So we would, you know, either walk or catch the bus, and on the way home from school, we would invariably catch the bus back down into town to then catch the bus home, because the number 51 bus which took us down into town was by the sweet shop. So we'd leave school and we'd go up and we'd get our 10p mix, because 10p was a lot in those days, and we'd get our chocolate cup and our chocolate covered banana and our candy watch or necklace, depending. Maybe sometimes a few toffees, but it's always a bit risky with the dentist. So, not that the others weren't, we'd then get our 10p mix, we'd sit at the bus stop and we'd wait for the number 51. Now the number 51 was, from what I gather, a little bit like the bus in Cottenham, that you're waiting and then all there's 2 or maybe 3 that come. So we'd wait for number 51 and we'd wait for ages. And then we were faced with the decision. Did we try and walk to the next bus stop, or did we stay and wait? Because we could get caught in between the two. Then we'd miss it and we'd have to walk all the way down into town. So we'd wait and we'd have that tricky decision. When do we leave? Do we leave? Do we stay? Do we walk? Do we stop? Do we not? Shall we? Shall we? Can you see it? Can you see it? Can anyone see it? It was tricky. I realise now that actually it wasn't a very important decision at all. Somewhat trivial. But at the time, for a teenager, walking was a big issue. So to wait or not to wait was actually a bit of a risk. Because it, waiting can be tricky, can't it? Whether it be waiting for a bus, or a train, or a doctor, or an operation, or a moment that we don't want to face, or whether it be waiting for something we've been looking forward to for ages, waiting can be tricky. And the longer we have to wait for something, the harder it seems to become. We want to do something to make it come quicker. And so it's somewhat appropriate that as we enter a time of Advent, a time of expectation, a time of looking forward to, a time of the coming of God, it's appropriate that today we come across a parable that is essentially all about waiting. Waiting for someone to arrive. The parable of the talents, it's often known as. And we know it's a parable about waiting because it takes place towards the end of the book of Matthew, during Jesus' final journey and his entrance into Jerusalem. Or if you like, it takes place during his journey and his entrance into the centre of the Jewish world, into the place where his final Passover meal will happen, into the place of his own death. And so it's no surprise that on this journey and this arrival, Jesus chooses to talk mainly about one topic, the end times, the final days, the time between his imminent departure from the world and the final coming and glorious return of God. And he addresses many issues in this journey. He talks of his death. He talks of his authority. He talks of the signs of the end times, what will happen during the final days. And then when he enters Jerusalem, after he has cursed a fig tree, turned over the tables in the temple, and confronted the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, he concludes his teaching by telling three parables. Parables about the kingdom of heaven, about the coming of the Son of Man, about the responsibility of those who are waiting for the return of God. And in the middle of this section of parables is the story that Rob read to us a few moments ago, the one we're going to look at today. It's a story of a master who goes away on a journey and leaves his servants in charge of all the money that he has. Now, what's clear from this parable is that firstly, the master has a lot of money. I mean, for instance, one bag of gold or one talent in the time this parable was told would now have equated to thousands and thousands of pounds. It was a huge sum of money for people who are listening. And so as we've heard, the master leaves one servant with five bags of gold, one servant with two bags, and the last servant with one bag of gold. Thousands of pounds. Meaning that each servant is left to look after a lot. They're left to hold a huge amount of responsibility. And not only that, but the second thing that becomes clear is that the servants are not just expected to look after this money they've been given, but they're expected to do something with it. They're expected to use it wisely. And we know this because when the master returns, he doesn't simply want his money back, but he comes back to settle accounts, to find out what each servant has done to further his fortune while he's been away. Now, of course, as we've heard, the first two servants have done extremely well. Both of them have doubled the money that they were given. They've increased the fortune that the master already had. And they receive great reward for that. They hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And then, contrary to the culture of the day, they're then given yet more responsibility for their diligence as servants to their master. They're not just given back what they originally had. They're not just given leave of the household, but they're given more responsibility. But the third servant is different. It seems that out of the three, this servant is the only one who is scared of the master, who has a view of him as someone who's not that kind. And so instead of investing the money, or doubling the money, or at least increasing it in some way, the servant has hidden the gold in the ground, so that when he's called to account on the arrival of the master, he simply returns the same amount of money that he'd been given in the first place. And for this, of course, he receives no reward. But also, quite astonishingly, instead, he's stripped of the gold and he's thrown into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Which leaves us with the impression, when we read this parable, that although there are lots of details, lots of things in it, what matters most is not how much the servants are given or how many servants there are or the conversation between the master and the servants, but rather how the servants look after what they have been given. Or if you like, what matters most about this parable is how well the servants wait for their master to return home. Now, when interpreted, this parable is clearly a parable about God and his people. It's a parable about God, the master in the parable, and the people who are the servants. It's a parable about the time between Jesus' resurrection and his return to the earth. It's a parable about what God's people should do with the gold, or as it's been interpreted, the gifts and talents that God has given while he is away. Or if you like, it's a parable about how we, as servants of God, should wait for his return to earth. Servants number one and two are those people who have used their gifts wisely as they wait for God to return, prompting much reward in the final day and great celebration. Whereas servant number three often stands for the person who has taken their gifts and hidden them, leaving them unused and undeveloped, prompting, of course, much punishment and great distress. Which, to be honest, I've always found a little bit harsh. I mean, apart from anything else, it just seems a bit too cruel on the third servant. It's true that the servant buried the money, or buried his talent, or buried what God had given him, but he didn't seem to do it out of laziness or disinterest. It wasn't like he was being dishonest, trying to steal the money for himself. He just wanted to keep the money safe. He wanted to keep it secure. He wanted to keep it pristine so that when God returned, or the master returned, it would not be damaged or stolen or lost. And yet when God returns, this servant's penalty for diligently keeping it safe is to be stripped of all he's been given and thrown into torment. Just as always seemed a little bit unfair to me. Because let's face it, protecting what God has given us is something the church has actively tried to do over the years. Surely it can't be wrong to do that. Well, maybe we need to take a look at how this parable would have first been understood. Because you see, when Jesus told this story, he didn't just tell it at any time, in any place. He told it into a specific culture. He told it into the Jewish culture, of course, a culture who understood what it was to follow and to carry and to look after the things of God. They'd done it for years throughout history. So when people first heard this parable, they would have known immediately that when Jesus refers to the master and the servants, he was referring to the ongoing relationship between God and his people Israel. And so for them, the huge amounts of money that the master entrusted to his servants, and the one reason they were so huge, was not because these riches were individual gifts dished out to be developed by individuals, but rather these bags of gold were a reference to the riches of the kingdom of God itself. And not only the riches that Israel had long been entrusted with, like the law and the temple and the presence of God among his people, the sacrifices, the community of Israel and the festivals that they kept every year. Not only those riches, but also the new riches that Jesus had made known throughout his life on earth, the image of God that they'd become aware of afresh, the grace of God, the free forgiveness of God, the revolution of the good news of the kingdom that Jesus had presented to them. All these things had been given to the servants, to the people of God, specifically so they could take them and make them known to those around by the way that they lived and treated each other. And so when reading this parable, as the people of the day would have read it or heard it, to be more accurate, it becomes much clearer why the third servant is treated so harshly. Because you see, it wasn't his talents and his gifts and his own personal things that God had given him that he was keeping to himself. It was the things of God. It was the riches of the kingdom. It was what God was like that he had buried, that he had hidden, that he had covered up, so that those outside would have no way of seeing what God was like. And that's why the penalty was so harsh, because in effect, the third servant was closing the doors to the kingdom of God, not allowing anyone else to see what God had for them, and ultimately hiding God from those around. To the people of the day, they may well have interpreted this servant's actions to be like the Pharisees, or the teachers of the law, or the scribes, the religious leaders who had been entrusted with so much and yet had put up barrier after barrier after barrier so that people couldn't reach God at all. Do you know, it makes me think a little bit of something that happened to us recently. Simon's brother moved house and he gave us lots of things that he'd kept over the years. He's a bit of a collector. He especially collects comic books, all in their sealed plastic cases. He reads them once, puts them back, and never reads them again. But he also collects action figures from the comics, and they're all in their boxes. He undoes them with a little knife, slips them out, and then puts them back in. And they've stood either on shelves in his house or in boxes for years, only touched once. And he came to us and he bought these boxes full of things which we know are so precious to him. And he's looked after them. And he said, "Do you know, I was thinking about these the other day and I thought, what's the point of having them in boxes, looking at them, and then maybe one day selling them?" He said, "I want to give them to James so that he can take them out of the boxes and he can play with them and he can enjoy them." And we were a bit bowled over, really, because this is what Matthew does. He collects these things and he saves them. And so now we have a number of little figures thrown around the room, looked at, picked apart. But the joy that they're bringing to James, Matthew finds much better than them stuck in a little case on a shelf or in a box. And you know, similarly, here in this parable, I believe Jesus is painting a picture which in effect says, you know, being servants of God, living our lives for God, or if you like, waiting for God to return, is not about living a life which diligently keeps the things of God safe and secure and pristine, uncorrupted by those around, and therefore buries them in the ground so that no one can change them or damage them, as the third servant and the Pharisees so desperately tried to do over the years. But rather, it's about taking what we know of the kingdom of God, and through the way we serve, through the way we are, through the things we do, opening the doors of the kingdom of God to others, taking the precious things of God out of the cases and handing them around to people who are looking. So that through our generosity and through our love, people will become more and more aware of what God is really like. and the kingdom will grow, just as God designed it to grow. You know, you could see it a bit like a little boy who was painting a picture one day, and his dad said to him, "What are you doing? What are you painting?" And he said, "I'm painting a picture of God." And the dad's like, "Well, you know, no one really knows what God is like, so that's a bit difficult." And the little boy didn't care. He carried on painting. He went, "When I've finished, everyone will know what God is like." And you know, that's what we can be like with the kingdom. When we finish being generous with what God has given us, everyone can know what God is really like. Because at the end of the day, the kingdom of God is God's kingdom, which means that it is rich and it is vast and it is full and it is abundant and it is for everyone. It's for everyone. But it's been given to us to make known to other people. And you know, as the parable points out, it doesn't matter how much we know about God. It doesn't matter how gifted we think we are. It doesn't matter how much experience we have of the things of his kingdom. What matters is that as servants of Jesus Christ, we do well with the things we've been given. We show them to others. And we make people aware of the little or the lot that we know. Or if you like, what really matters as servants of Jesus Christ is how well we wait for our Master to return.